It was a place frequented by smart shoppers, and was done up to please them. I had finished and was preparing to leave, when I caught sight of two women whom I knew entering the place. They were busy chatting and failed to see me, but they sat down close to where I was, with their backs towards me. Not really wishing to meet them, I hesitated before getting up to leave. They were still talking. Roberta was a ringleader type, she was that kind of person, and she had that kind of carrying voice. "My dear, did you hear about Sheila?" "No." This was going to be interesting. I stayed put. She paused and I guessed the other one, Jane, was shaking her head. Roberta continued in a lower, supercharged voice, the type of voice you use when you have juicy news to impart, something hot off the press. "Well, and I got this from Cordelia, so it must be true." She paused again for even greater effect. "She's left John. Good Lord. No. Really, how extraordinary. Has she run off with that young David who's always mooning around after her?" Jane was incredulous, but all the same fascinated. "No, no, my dear, much worse than that, much worse. You'll never believe it, you really won't." Another pregnant pause. "She's gone off with some sort of yogi, or something. He's written a book, apparently. Good Lord. Amazing. A yogi? One of those natives who sit around naked? Poor John. She must have gone completely mad. It must be the pregnancy. She's nearly due, isn't she?" "Yes, but then, you know, John only married her on the rebound after that affair with the bishop's daughter, you know, Sally," said Roberta with authority. "You remember, old Marrows was really cut up when she jilted him. The church and all that, right up her street for a daughter-in-law. Never approved of Sheila, you know. Of course, she was just a child when he married her, didn't know a thing, probably still doesn't, come to that. Cordelia's going to dine out for weeks on this. She's so clever at taking people off." They both laughed.
"What about the children?" asked Jane.
"Oh, I'm told they're in the country with Ma Rouse. She's got a sensible nanny for them. They'll be so much better off. Sheila ruined them, hasn't a clue about discipline. Poor girl, they'll probably lock her up in one of those asylums when she comes back. It's the only thing to do with those sort of cases." At that point the waitress tripped up to their table and they started to give their order. I got up and turned to walk out of the place, passing them as I went. Deliberately I stopped beside their table. "Roberta, Jane, how nice to see you both. I thought you would be in the country like everyone else." I bestowed my best and most charming smile upon them. Roberta looked at me, her eyebrows arched and her long aquiline nose twitching slightly, making her look more than ever like an overbred racehorse. "My dear," she drawled, "how delightful. We were just saying we hadn't seen you for absolutely ages, weren't we, Jane? Absolutely ages." Jane was busy with her gloves, barely looking at me. Then she glanced up and said, "Oh, yes. That's right, we haven't seen you for ages, absolutely ages." She gave what passed for a smile, looking at me through her pert little eye veil. I almost felt sorry for her. Poor girl, poor, poor girl. It was laughable. "And how are those darling children?" she went on, recovering herself a little. "So far as I know, doing very well," I told her. "Sensible nannies and mothers-in-law know how to do it, don't they? But, incidentally, Roberta, you've got it a bit wrong, you know. The word is not yogi. It's llama, with one L to distinguish it, you know, from the long-necked creature that roams around in the Andes, or somewhere." "What? You don't know what a llama is? My dear, you should read the book, it's called The Third Eye. Everyone's reading it. Now I really must fly. Lovely to see you both." I made for the door without a backward glance. I walked up Bond Street to catch a bus home. Although I felt I had won that round, there would be dozens of others I would probably never even know about. So what did it matter? They could all go to hell, for all I cared, and good riddance. All the same, I did feel a bit rattled and out of sorts, not quite right somehow.
They really were incredibly horrible, those two women. I loathed them both at that moment quite heartily. As I sat on the bus, I began to wish I had taken a taxi. The bus was so jolty, so slow, it seemed that the whole of Oxford Street was blocked with traffic. I began to be sure the baby was imminent. I just had that feeling. I was supposed to be going to a hospital for the birth, but was not looking forward to it. I had never been in a hospital before. When I arrived home, I went straight to my room and lay down on the bed. It was not long before Ab appeared at the door with a cup of tea. They must have sensed something was wrong. "Are you all right?" she asked. "I don't know. I have a feeling the baby is on the way. Can we send for the doctor? I'll get Chen to come and look at you, but we'll send for a doctor right away if you like. There may not be time to get you to hospital." She was a nurse and he was a doctor, so they were calm, experienced. Chen came and looked at me, then he placed his hands with the palms over my eyes and his fingers spread over my head. He told me to relax, and I felt an indescribable peace and calm flood my mind. It was as though there were no worries. It was as though I had been given some marvelous gift which allowed me to see above and beyond, to get away from pain and the confines of the flesh. I felt free and happy. It was in that state of mind that my third child, a boy, was born not very long after, and I can remember nothing difficult about it. Rab had contacted a doctor and a midwife, but the latter did not arrive until after the birth, the doctor arriving a few hours later. It was Chen who brought the child into the world, who washed him and wrapped him in warm clothes. As I turned and heard the child utter his first cry, I distinctly saw a golden glow around Chen's head. That was the first and only time I saw it during all the years I was to know him, and I put it down to the fact that I was in an altered state and able to see what normally I would not have seen. To my understanding, it was the nimbus, or higher force possessed by advanced entities, and not the same thing as the aura which we all possess and which is composed of lines of force such as a magnet is around it, but of different colors, more colors than we are capable of seeing and less clairvoyant. What I saw that day was what one would call the halo. Curiously, or perhaps not so curiously, my second son, while resembling John physically, is endowed with exceptional insight and awareness, and his lifestyle today is one to which I have aspired but never achieved. I am convinced that the first moments of life are vital to an individual's development, and somehow set a pattern for the life ahead, like an indelible stamp on the blueprint of life. It was a cold, dismal day of midwinter, already late afternoon and past time to turn on lights and draw curtains when John arrived for his third visit. He came unannounced and found me resting, the three-week-old baby, whom we had decided to name Kanda, in his cradle beside my bed. He took a cursory look at the baby, at that age beauty truly lies in the eyes of the beholder, then removed his black Crombie overcoat, casually throwing it across the foot of my bed. I remained resting, my head on the large square pillow, as I watched him. He took the big easy chair, which seemed to accommodate him well. It was covered with dark red velvet, the kind that never ever wears out, and must have been on that chair for years. It must have had scores of people sitting on it. It retained a faint, not unpleasant smell of tobacco, cigars, I would say. It just had that smell of a certain kind of well-to-do family, solid, unshakable, the kind of family that also goes on for years and years just like the chair, indestructible. It suited my husband. I got up and crossed to the window to draw the curtains across and shut out the night. I clicked the switch of the small lamp beside my bed, hoping not to disturb the baby. We said nothing. As I resumed my resting position, John got out his silver cigarette case and offered it to me. "No, thanks, John." We were always polite, but his inability to remember my not smoking or drinking when pregnant or breastfeeding was infuriating. I continued to watch him as he lit his cigarette, so complacent, so privileged, so well dressed and composed. I knew then that I could never return to him. I knew his life was not for me. He stifled me, and he, for his part, must have felt immense annoyance towards me, although he seldom showed it. He was superbly restrained. Eventually he spoke, "Darling, do you have any idea what you want to do? I think we have to make some decision about the child for one thing. Nanny is marvelous. The children love her, they've never been better. She'd adore a baby to take care of. Easier for you. I don't think you're well enough to look after him. You have to think of yourself, you know. You have to take care not to overdo it. I don't know what you mean. I'm not sick or anything." I was defensive. Do you have an ashtray?" He was treating me with caution. "Look, John, I'll have to think about it. I know it's hard for you. I know you find me difficult." I was desperately trying to be reasonable, but to make a decision of that kind immediately was impossible. "I'll telephone you tomorrow, I need to sleep on it." When he left, he kissed me gently on the forehead. He had never told me he loved me, and there is no reason to suppose that he did, yet I was the mother of his children, I had taken care of them and of him, and for that he was grateful. The next day I rang him up and told him I was not returning, and Kanda should be taken to the bosom of the family where he would grow up with the privileges his birth accorded him. I had no clear idea of my own future, but I felt it did not include money or position or worldly security of any kind. I had no wish for those things anymore. Did I ever regret that decision? Yes, I feel sure that from time to time I did. Probably more often than I actually remember, because one tends to block out memories one finds unpleasant. Sometimes, I may have felt unable to manage the path I had chosen. But at the end of the day, in other words, now, no, I have no regrets. I stayed the course and I think I learned from it. In my belief, what we learn in life is what we take back to our overself when we leave the physical body in death. So, ultimately, that is what counts, that is what it is all about. When people read a book that impresses them, they often feel the urge to write to the author. Chen received a great many letters from a wide variety of readers. He read them all. They would be forwarded on from the publisher and would arrive, usually with an elastic band around them because there were a lot. Methodically he would slit open the envelope with his paper knife, examining the writing. As he read the letters he would place them in piles. These required a short acknowledgement only, those required thought and a detailed answer, others asked for and needed no response. Obviously, he preferred the latter. It was a heavy workload and for a time he did it almost single-handed, that is to say, Rab addressed envelopes, folded the letters and posted them. It was not until Candy had gone to live with his father and siblings that I became involved with the letters, and I was at such a loose end then that I was thankful to have something to do. In a way, it grew on me and gradually, over many years, and as Chen had to write more books as well as pursue his research, it fell to me to take a large role in dealing with the fan mail. He always opened letters, read or scanned them according to their importance and need, then handed them to me and we discussed his reply. Sometimes he would dictate a reply, at others he would simply indicate the gist or say, "You know what to say." It was an interesting experience, like having a crowd of acquaintances you never met, but because they often wrote very frankly of their problems and lives in general, you came to know them thoroughly. It was a unique lesson in humanity, and one I enjoyed and benefited from. As well, I learned a great deal in an indirect fashion from Chen's replies to involved questions relating to occult and metaphysical matters. I came to respect the readers who already were possessed of significant knowledge, who were deeply spiritual and often lived modest lives. I was fascinated by the number of people who had had spiritual, esoteric experiences and were writing, not only to relate their experiences, but also because they may not have fully understood them. I loved the gentleness and unworldliness of so many who wrote. I loved and appreciated the understanding of so many intelligent individuals. Unavoidably, there were those whom we labeled crackpot male, but there were surprisingly few of those. Perhaps they were not sound mentally and were ready to latch onto anything out of the ordinary. We treated them with tact, if replying at all, but with finality. Contrary to popular belief, I was never a student sitting at Chen's feet, ingesting esoteric knowledge. I learnt in a different and perhaps more thorough way. What I know is what over the years I absorbed from him. It was not the kind of learning possessed, for instance, by academics who are taught with the idea that they be able to discuss what they know in a scholarly fashion. What they learn and what they are able to discuss does not necessarily become a part of them, it may well remain only in the conscious mind, and we are only 1/10 conscious. On the other hand, erudition which has been absorbed, on which has rubbed off unconsciously through contact with an adept, may not be something one can discuss in a scholarly manner, yet it is knowledge that has become deeply ingrained into the subconscious, it becomes a permanent part of one's inner knowing. If you look up the word metaphysics in the dictionary, you will see that it is described as the science and causes of all things existing, the philosophy of mind as distinguished from that of matter. And if you wonder exactly what a psychic person is, that could be defined as one who is aware of multi-dimensional worlds, not just our three-dimensional world, one who can see and experience what normal three-dimensional people cannot. In the same way, to make it perhaps a little more clear, a normal human being who is three-dimensional can see and experience what an amoeba which is one-dimensional cannot. The knowledge and understanding I gained during the years I spent with Chen could come under the heading of those two words, metaphysics and psychic. Many people wonder about many things, but one of the main questions was about the Akashic Record. What is it? Who can see it? The Akashic Record is the record of everything that has ever happened impressed on the ether in much the same way as light impulses are recorded on sign film. In the astral state it is possible to see what you want to see on that record, just as now we can see things on the internet. The internet, however, is completely different from the Akashic in that it consists only of what people have entered into it, not necessarily true facts, while the Akashic is a record of what actually has occurred. And the Akashic record of probabilities can perhaps be best explained in this way. Imagine a train on a track as seen from above, as seen from a balloon or an aeroplane high above the earth. From that vantage point, it is possible to see the track ahead, and one may see that the train is headed for a crash because the points are not set correctly. But it is not a definite fact until it has happened, because someone might come along in the nick of time and set the points so that the train will pass over that potentially dangerous bit of track, and arrive on time in good shape. So the Akashic record of probabilities is a good indication of just that, probabilities. It would be wrong to give the impression that psychics sit around and look at the Akashic record as people sit around and watch television, often mindlessly. Even with psychic ability, it requires knowledge and energy to get far enough into the astral to be able to consult the Akashic in the way that Chen was able to do. At that time, the period when the Third Eye was published, there were numerous negative forces actively attempting to disrupt and cause annoyance to him, and Chen had to be mindful of it all in order to combat it. The reader will be aware by now that he was focused only on getting his task connected with the human aura completed. That was his aim and purpose. Everything else was secondary, and every move he made was towards that goal. His life was conducted as a game of chess, and his moves were made with care and forethought. He considered his work of importance to the human race, and thus to the universe. There were few people capable of doing it, and he intended to remain alive until that work was accomplished. So it was that he needed to be left entirely alone at night. I was asked never to disturb him because he traveled far, far out of the body in the astral state, attached to the physical body, as we all are, by the silver cord, and a sudden disturbance could bring him back too abruptly. It could even cause death, or, at the best, a severe headache and nausea. At that time he would appear white and drawn in the morning, and the sight of the pineal gland, or the third eye in the center of the forehead, would be angry red and sore looking. We would know he had been consulting with others in the astral. Sometimes he talked about it, at other times he remained silent, and one knew better than to question him. As one example of the negative forces I just mentioned, we had a visit from two Scotland Yard detectives during the time we lived in the London flat together. I remember the day distinctly because Rab had been out to buy herself a dress, and we had had discussions about where she should shop. She ended up at Jigger in Regent Street, and came home with a charming blue tweedy dress which suited her admirably. She had tried it on to show us and was still wearing it when Chen, who was in his customary place by the window, suddenly exclaimed, "Ah, here they are at last. Here who are?" I asked, as I crossed the room to join him at the window. "You see those two men?" He indicated a pair of men with Homburg hats pulled well down over their eyes and wearing identical raincoats, walking closely side by side. Rab had come to the window. "They look like police," she said. It was a fact, they looked exactly like the cops in the cops and robber films that excited us as children, and they had a kind of gliding more than walking movement about them. "That's just what they are, policemen," Chen said. "I've been expecting them. They're coming here." He got up. "I'll put my jacket on in honor of them. Police don't like anything different, especially when dealing with foreigners." He was making light of it, as he always did. But even so, one knew how distasteful and difficult these situations were for him. It is bad enough for a non-psychic person to be interviewed by police, but for a psychic, it must be quite dreadful to see into their minds. He was wearing a comfortable saffron-colored robe made by Rab when he was photographed for book publicity. He liked the robe and had taken to wearing it in the house instead of his suit, but now he was going to change into his jacket to appear more conventional. The two men disappeared from our view as they neared the building. I was alarmed. Police meant trouble of some sort. Even if one is as innocent and pure as the driven snow, there is still a feeling of alarm when a policeman arrives at the door. When the bell rang and they did indeed announce themselves as being from Scotland Yard, I would go so far as to say it was a frightening experience. But they were courteous and after a brief visit left, satisfied. It transpired that they were investigating a complaint that Chen was running an unregistered nursing home. Was it not true that a child had been born here in this very place recently? Who was the child? Where was the mother? What was the explanation? "I'm sorry, Sheila, it's your parents. They don't like me. They'll make trouble as long as they can," Chen told me. I was mortified. I felt responsible for the trouble he was having to face, but there was nothing to be done. It was amazing to me then, as I still was not fully aware of Chen's abilities, that he knew the police were on the warpath. He laughed. "I don't just write about things, you know," he said. Apart from that experience, life in London was beginning to be difficult. Chen had become too well known and sought after to be able to remain as private as he wished, and needed, to be. He decided that we should move to a quieter place, and somewhere where perhaps the taxes would not be so exorbitant for writers as they were in England. There were few choices, and eventually we decided to move to Ireland, to Dublin. It turned out to be a good choice. It was the beginning of one of the best periods for Chen's work. He made progress with research. He continued to write. The atmosphere and close proximity to the sea were very conducive to psychic work. We answered an advertisement which was brief and to the point, furnished flat to rent, central Dublin, and took the place sight unseen. This was the first of many, many moves over the next 20 years or so, and it was actually one of the most pleasant and successful for us all. Chapter 5. Generally speaking, preconceived notions about places and people lead to grand disillusionment. But such was not the case with Ireland. It is hard to say now where my notions had originated, and I can only assume it was from books we read as small children, and perhaps, also, from our maternal grandmother's collection of old Irish silver and the stories she attached to each piece. She was an imaginative woman. My brother and I were what you might call precocious, or advanced, readers. Then there was no television. We read a great deal, and books at that time were almost works of art. It was a truly tactile experience to hold a well-bound book, usually beautifully illustrated, in one's hands. We graduated quickly from the bedtime stories our mother read to us at a tender age, going on to reading to ourselves while still very young, before we went to school even. With her we had agonized, gloried and shivered through the Lancashire witches, onto Greek mythology, neither of which ensured a peaceful night's rest. By the time we were able to bury our heads in our own books, we had acquired quite a sense of literature. My brother would be engrossed in Stork and Co., Treasure Island, The Scarlet Pimpernel, or The Adventures of Dick Hanley, while I was sculling down the river with Ratty, following Alice and the White Rabbit with Pink Eyes down the rabbit hole, or riding on Nana's back with the Darling Children. So where did the Irish stories come in? Well, for one, there was a wonderful book, a large book it was, I can almost see it now, thick paper and every so often a marvelously graphic picture of fairies, goblins, and leprechauns, odd little fellows with tall hats. And there were tales of tinkers and donkeys, ruined castles shrouded in mist. It was enchanting. I loved it and I lived it, although for the life of me I cannot remember its title. And then, of course, there was Irish poetry, romantic, magical stuff that went round and round in one's head, leading to serious daydreaming and lack of attention when forced to go to school, where I sat at the back enveloped in a mystical land of castles and leprechauns. Our grandmother's Irish silver and the stories that went with it only added to the romance of the place. Why she collected Irish silver is a mystery. It may have been an oblique method of causing annoyance to my grandfather, who was Scottish, she herself being from Yorkshire, or it may simply have been that Irish silver was hard to come by, so the challenge of collecting it was far greater. What made it even more of a challenge was that she favored women silversmiths, and there were fewer of the fair sex in the trade. Now I come to think of it, it seems to me that our grandmother must have been a forerunner of the women's liberation movement, heavily disguised. Like her sister, my great-aunt Jeanie, the one who was fay, she was petite and delicate in appearance, and she used lily-of-the-valley toiletries. Wherever Granny had been, the elusive scent hung briefly and faintly in the air, attesting to her recent presence. From Granny I learned about such women as Annie Nolan of Loughrea, County Galway, who was busily engaged in silversmithing around 1780. Granny owned a lovely chocolate pot with this lady's mark, along with the date and place marks, and I was made to feel it and then compare the feeling with modern machine-made silver. Not the same thing at all. The former was like silk compared to the coarser touch of the latter. Then she had, and used daily, a wonderful tea set, quite ornate in fact, made by a Dorothy Mountjoy, or, as she liked to tell everyone, really Mountjoy but pronounced Mountjoy, because, as people were not terribly well educated in those days, they would not have known how to pronounce the name correctly had it not been written as it was spoken. Those days referred to the early 18th century, earlier than Annie Nolan, and Dorothy worked in Kilkenny. And there were others too, one who made buttons, and several from Dublin. They all had stories attached to them, made up, I feel sure, by Granny. She told about their houses, the clothes they wore, their husbands and children, of which they seemed to have an astonishingly large number, leading one to question how they had time to ploy their craft. They were strong, Granny said with satisfaction. All this was a positive beginning to a new life. Although I had no physical knowledge or acquaintance with Ireland, other than a friendship with an Irish girl at school for a time, I felt I knew where I was going. It was exciting and attractive. And I had the natural optimism and curiosity of youth on my side. As I contemplate my magic painting, the picture I am attempting to bring to life in words, the colors of this particular area are clear and bright, the shapes are well defined and the heavy dark clouds are giving way to lighter hues. It was a good time, at least for a while. Our landlady in Dublin had a title and a bicycle. The latter was of far greater use to her than the former, which carried little prestige and no wealth, but she did own and live in a castle in the Wicklow Mountains outside Dublin. The place was mostly in ruins, but it readily fulfilled my dreams of castles looming up out of the mist. The bicycle was quite splendid, a shiny black Rolly with a red stripe, and it took her everywhere. Attached to the handlebars was a large wicker basket in which Ping, her aristocratic and cross Pekingese dog, rode. Pong, so she told us, had come to a sad and gory end only 2 years previously, and I liked to think, because I am inclined to give dogs the benefit of the doubt, that his untimely demise had contributed largely to Ping's displeasure with life in general. Lady Shane, as was her name, invited me to tea not too long after we moved into the flat.